CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
Whitney realized what she needs to do is scream at the audience, and then they laugh. So she's a very loud comic. Yeah.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Scher from CinemaSins.
Hey.
And today we have a very special guest. It is director, and you know, you're a multi-hyphenate, right? You're stand-up comedian, Steve Byrne,
yeah,
who has directed a movie called The Opening Act, starring Jimmy O. Yang, Alex Moffat, Cedric the Entertainer, and a whole bunch of stand-up comics that you've seen before, playing all sorts of different roles too. They're not just stand-up comics in this. There's some people, they're playing some actual people.
just obviously stand-up comedians.
That's right. Not in my book. They're not. No. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much. And Chris, I got to tell you, nobody does that intro bullshit better than you.
Awesome. Yeah, see, you know what? I'm going to put that on all of our podcast stuff. Like Steve Byrne says, I do the intro bullshit better than anybody.
I never heard anybody. All right, well, let's get started. I'm going to get this intro bullshit over. It's yeah. Like, all right, yeah. Here we go.
It's like, I was thinking about it today. I was like, you know, saw Jimmy O. Yang in this movie. I saw him in Fantasy Island earlier this year. Yeah. And I was like, I can definitely tell Steve Byrne that his movie, The Opening Act, is better than Fantasy Island.
That's right.
And he can put it
on the benchmark. That's always been the benchmark.
He can put it on the poster. You know,
Chris Atkinson said. I saw that in Pauly Shore's House Guest. I'm like, guys, the bar has been set.
I will say Yang is the best part of Fantasy Island, like by far. Like mm-hmm. It's not even close.
Oh, nice. Well, that's good to hear.
The first question I want to ask, is this movie autobiographical?
It certainly is semi-autobiographical. I think once the character Will Chu hits the road, everything that's happened to him has happened to me in terms of the conversations in the diner between, you know, Billy G and Will. I've had those as a young comic, and I have them now as an established headliner with younger comics. Everything. The radio is a combination of KLOS in Los Angeles and another radio station, I believe, in upstate New York. The trailer park incident happened to me in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Oh, wow.
The bachelorette party, which was a truncated scene, there was a lot more to it. That happened to me, and I witnessed it in Dallas, Texas at the Addison Improv. All those things happened to me. The condos, all that stuff, it's all real. The one thing that's kind of real in the first act, my father, thankfully, is still alive, so is my mother, but my father and I did bond over stand-up comedy when I was younger. We used to watch Evening at the Improv with Bud Friedman, Caroline's yeah. Comedy Hour, and Gallagher, Dangerfield, Young Comedian specials. My father, my brother, and I used to watch those all the time together. So there's an element of truth in that. But once he hits the road, it all happened.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's one of these things, you know, we've seen Mike Birbiglia and Sleepwalk with Me, and what's the show that was on HBO?
Crashing,
yes. Yep. It seems like stand-up comics almost have like not a rock star lifestyle, but like it's like a parody of a rock star lifestyle almost.
There's a lot of truth to that. I couldn't have said it better. It's almost like we're the roadie or the keyboard player in a rock band. It's like, kind of in the band, right? It definitely, you know, you do get the spotlight shone on you, and there's definitely comedy groupies, but it's definitely not to the magnitude of a rock star life. And I know Pete, I know Mike, I respect those guys, and even Big Sick or Obvious Child. You go back to Punchline. Mm-hmm. I always felt like those films are good. Right. I think they're good. I don't think they're great. And mm-hmm. when I put pen to paper, my show had gotten canceled and I was back at the clubs meeting chicken fingers again and missing my family. And I'm just like, what's the only way I'm ever going to work is if I write something. You know, there's the case with Sullivan and Son. It's going to be the case with this. So my phone's not ringing off the hook. What am I going to do? What am I going to write? And I thought the one thing I've never seen is truly a great film about stand-up comedy, a mm-hmm. film that just focuses on stand-up comedy, a film that focuses on what it takes to make it. And as I started thinking more and more about it, I was like, there have been a few films like Road Hard. It's like, I don't want to watch a film about a 50-year-old driving home from Vegas. I want to watch a film about a 20-year-old driving to Las Vegas for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And that was the impetus to go back to the beginning and really encapsulate fish out of water experience for a young kid to show the audience what it really is like to be a stand-up comedian and what the lay of the land is for a professional comedy show that you go to, everything from the getting the red light to the comedy intros to the comedy condo to doing morning radio and all the trials and tribulations, especially as a young comic. You're thinking, holy shit, this is great, but at the same time there's so much to it. So if I were to relay it to everybody, it's like everybody's been to a comedy club, but not everybody's been on the road. And that's what this film's about.
Yeah. It's always interesting. And I love that drive, by the way, that he takes, because there is an excitement to it when he gets that call to, you know, from Ken Jeong to, you know, like, you know, he's finally going to at least get his foot in the door of a place. And he's driving into, you know, Pittsburgh or whatever. And
yep.
And there is a palpable excitement to that. And then of course, immediately the hammer drops and
yeah,
his name is misspelled on the marquee. He's getting accosted by bouncers. And then the club owner, played by Neil Brennan in a great performance there, has a lot of rules and like weird standards that he has to follow. And he realizes quickly that this isn't just about stand-up comedy anymore. This is, you know, there's a lot of like other little housekeeping things he's going to have to do.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's show business, right? And once you hit the road, that's you're introduced to the business of show, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The
machinations are what fascinates me so much about this, because you see him repeat the same joke every night that he's doing this MC thing, and you don't think about that, right? Every audience is experiencing this for the first time, but you know the comic is there for, you know, however many times he tells it, hundreds of times,
sure.
And he or she has to present this as good as it was that first time, and that kind of peek behind the curtain, not let alone the stuff of the tears between the MC and the featured and the headliner. Really, just like you said, this is a unique look at stand-up that you didn't get from something like a movie that I actually really like is Punchline that you mentioned.
I really appreciated that. And yeah. Actually, if you'll notice, when Ken Jeong calls, Jimmy, he says, "Hey, I got a big shot opening for Stephen Gold this weekend." That was Tom Hanks's character's name from
Punchline. Oh, shit. Wow. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I threw that in there as a little acknowledgement to Tom Hanks, because I saw that movie and there are elements of the film that are great, but I'm telling you, that fucking scene when he breaks down in front of his father and then shifts gears and then gets back into a set, it's one of the most amazing, you know, like examples of acting I've ever seen. And I think that's why he's been working all these years, but I fucking love that scene. It's so good. So, mm-hmm. so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, when Jimmy's doing the a lot of pretty girls in Pennsylvania, right? Well, not here, but like downtown. Like when you're starting, like you have 5 minutes. You have, you might have 3 great minutes, but you got like 2 minutes of filler and he's got to do 10. So you're just grasping for straws at that point. So yeah, when you're an MC, you are doing the same material over and over and over again.
And oh my God, do you let us see those grasping at straws? You are not afraid to be like, nope, let's stick with this for a while. You think we're going to cut away? Mm-mm, no.
Oh, yeah.
That's the, like, you know, it's one thing for Cedric to say, you know, for example, you're going to hear a whole avalanche of no's if you stay in this business. It really is a profession of rejection on a nightly basis during the day. If you're somewhat motivated, like most young comics are not, you're going to write something down. You're going to take it to stage, and 9 times out of 10, it's not going to work. That's the ratio. And so you're constantly being told by the audience no, by the industry no, by club owners no, because there's 1,000 comics that you're competing against. So it really, really takes a long time to become a good stand-up comedian. I remember Mark Maron, when I first passed the Comedy Cellar, I again was Will Chu. I'm asking him for advice, and he says it's going to take you 10 years to discover your voice as a comedian. Mm-hmm. And I was young and cavalier thinking, this guy's a fucking idiot. It took me 12 years. 12 years. And I told him that when I had done his podcast. And he's done well for himself, right?
Yeah, I would say so. But Glow got canceled, though. So, I mean.
It did, but he was in Joker, and I would go to the grave with that.
He was what now? What did you say?
He was a Joker, and I would go to the grave with that. I'd be like, I'm done. I was in a scene with De Niro. I'm in one of the greatest comic films of all time. It's like, we're good.
I've always felt a lot of empathy for these opening acts, and I've seen a lot of stand-up comics live over the years, and like, it's just, man, when that first guy, especially the guy who's just before the other guy, is coming up there, and he has that just limited amount of time and everything. It's just like, I'm rooting for you, man. I want you to do well and everything. That's the thing that goes on with this, which leads into what I think a lot of this movie is about, is about the lack of confidence or the loss of confidence that you get. And you can get into this big, huge spiral. He starts off screwing up the Cedric the Entertainer thing at the beginning, mm-hmm. Not being able to properly name his book and where you know him from. And so he starts off on that, and then he has the wild, you know, trailer, you know, girl wants to give him a blowjob scene. And then, like, you know, right after that, he's got to do this radio show.
Yep.
And it's a very unfunny radio show, but you would think that there's no pressure to be funny on something like that.
No, on those radio shows, it's you know, you're there representing the comedy club, and usually the comedy club's paid for that spot, so they're literally invested in it, and you got to do a good job. And I remember the first time I ever did radio was on Howard Stern when he was on radio before he went to Sirius. And I fucking ate a plate of dicks. I would say a buffet of dicks. It was so horrible. It scarred me. And literally the second time I did radio was that KLOS thing where I got kicked off the air while we're on the air. In real life, what actually happened was it was Frank, Heidi, and Frosty. And I actually had my booking agent at the time was named Frosty. And I'd always have like these, you know, like guys sometimes, you know, like little flirtatious gay jokes that you jab each other with or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not that either of us were, and not that there's anything wrong with that. But I go on doing it. I start doing it with Frosty, and they're like, Steve, how you doing today? I'm like, oh, you know, Frosty and I, we had a rough one last night. I was in a hot tub with him watching some Pixar films, and he had a loofah sponge. And he immediately took offense to this.
Oh.
And I lit a fuse. And what I learned in the aftermath is that he's very sensitive about those kinds of things. And I just hadn't listened to the show. I end up getting kicked off the air. They're asking for security to come and escort me out of the building. I'm like, are you guys serious? They're like, yeah. And I was like, I was just sitting there dumbfounded. I walk across the street. And at the time, the radio station was across the street from Sebastian Maniscalco. I walk over to his place. He goes, what's up? I go, turn on your radio. He turns on the radio. They are shitting on me for the next 30 minutes.
Oh, wow.
I'm not funny. I'm not charismatic. Why am I in Los Angeles? It's like all those things Jimmy's hearing in the car. Sebastian, of all people, is just staring at me. They cut to break and he goes, what the fuck did you do, guy? And that was my second radio experience. So I would say I started off in the deepest, darkest hole, beyond rock bottom with Stern, and then the biggest radio show in Los Angeles. It was brutal.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're trying to establish yourself and you know, you're trying to get some footing. And I don't know how stand-up comics do it, man. I don't know how they sit there like Whitney Cummings at the end of this movie when you're doing all the candid interviews and everything. She's like, I just accidentally was good the first time. And yep. then for 2 years, nothing. Like, how did you do this for 2 years, not getting us like any laughs at all?
Well, I think
you must really love it, you know.
Whitney realized what she needs to do is scream at the audience, and then they laugh. So she's a very loud comic. Yeah. I just have to raise my voice 8 octaves and tell them every. It's like, Whitney, my God, do you have a microphone?
So true. So true. Yeah. You know, who I thought was surprising in this was Alex Moffat, because I had seen him.
Great. He was great.
I saw, you know, I know him only from Saturday Night Live. So,
Show, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, steals the movie. The character was written as when Jimmy finally warms up to Billy G, the baton gets passed, and you start seeing through the cracks of the first 48 hours of hanging out with Chris Palmer and realizing, oh, maybe this guy is not a good influence, you know, to hang out with.
Right.
And what we learn in test screening is that the audience didn't like what I had written in terms of the character, because they're like, we invested in this character for the last 30 minutes. We really like him. Mm-hmm. And don't do that to him. And so Alex had so many takes where he's just such a likable guy, and he put a different spin on the character, because there were scenes written that he was supposed to be even more douchier than he is.
Oh, wow.
And over time, you learn that this guy is not who he kind of seems to be. And Alex just played it in a different way, where it's like, he's still great. He's still a great guy. You still want to hang out with him. And so we had to recalibrate just a touch, but Alex is one of those guys from A to Z, he always tested really, really high, no matter what we did with him in the edit. And it's a testament to him and the fiber of his character. And he's, you know, when you're casting these films, I think everybody has an opinion. He's the one guy I fought really hard for, because again, he's not on social media. Nobody really knows who he is. And he had done an independent film that I'd seen. And it was actually Colin Jost, who's on Update, that recommended him to me. Mm-hmm. When Colin and I were discussing the film, he said, you know, who might be good for that is Moffat. And I like yourself, I'd known Moffat from SNL, and I watched this independent film. I think it's called like Uncle John or Uncle Henry or something like that.
Seen this. John Ashton, right?
Yeah. And yeah, so good. And I was like, guys, trust me, he's the guy. And there's also an element, like, look, these days you have to worry about diversity when you're casting, right? Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're going to get slammed. But we didn't really have that problem, because the world of stand-up comedy is diverse in its own nature. But I told everybody when we were doing this, I go, I'm telling you right now, if we cast a young black comedian to play the role of Chris Palmer, we're going to get raked over the coals by progressive outlets like the Huffington Post, even though it's not intentional, right? But they're going to say, oh, so the black comic's the guy that wants to go out and just bang girls and he's unmotivated. It's like, you could see that coming at you, given the state of, you know, everybody has an outlet via media in the internet, you know? So mm-hmm. I was just like, that's one stumbling block I just wanted to avoid when we were casting, which is disheartening, you know?
Yeah.
And it's something I never would have thought of unless I was on the other side of things casting.
That is right. Fascinating. The white guy was the key to the diversity.
That's right. You're completely
right. You're absolutely right. But it's just so odd to hear it framed like that, you know?
Because if we cast, you know, there's all these conversations, for example, when we were doing it. And if I don't want to say the original way we had dreamt things up, but if we did cast 3 white comics, right? If we cast 2 white comics, I mean, you know, you're going to get raked over the coals. Somebody's going to go look at that poster and go, well, that doesn't represent stand-up comedy. It's just like, you want to avoid those conversations. Found that part of the casting process, it was a little unnerving to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. There is one performer in here that I'd seen before in Sorry to Bother You, Jermaine Fowler, who is great. I'm actually hoping to see him a lot more now that I've seen him in this and in Sorry to Bother You. He's fantastic.
Is he the DJ?
Yeah, he's the DJ.
Sound guy,
oh
yeah.
My God, that's one of my It's my, you talk about stealing the movie. He kind of steals the movie for me because like the one part where he's just going through this line of the amount of drugs. He's like, you want some coke? You want some this? And then he'll come back and be like, how about ecstasy? And then Jimmy O'Gang's like, is everything okay at home?
Well, those guys,
yeah. Away a laugh. I'm sorry.
Those sound guys are usually the guys that take you to radio in the morning, as Ricky does. And they're the guys that they never did stand up. They're exposed to it every night. And they like to be around the element of like, this guy's famous for the night, right? So they like to be kind of like a hanger on. And 9 times out of 10, when you're on the road and you don't know anybody, and the sound guy is usually the guy that goes, hey, man, let's go to the strip club. Because they're the ones that are constantly taking comics to radio to go get something to eat, for little errands. Or if you want to go out at night, that's usually the guy you go out with. Wow. And they got all the hookups, like literally all the hookups. So stay away from the sound guy.
I imagine so. It makes sense.
And then Cedric, the entertainer, I've never seen him like this in anything. He's a good actor. He's always been a good actor. He's a very funny guy, but like his performance in this is just like, I feel like he goes places that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. We were very, very lucky to have him, to be completely honest. And it's one of those things again in casting where things can fall apart. You know, Alex Moffat, for example, we were shooting Friday. The ink dried on his contract Thursday afternoon, and he got on a red eye Thursday evening to fly in to do the first day of shooting. So that's how close we were.
He was Jimmy O Yang in the movie, basically. Like he was.
Yeah. 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 And then Cedric, there was some, you know, complications with getting him all set in stone. And then he finally, like, you know, it was finally happening, like, I think the day before his first day too. And you just see those scenes play out. And I think about what could have been had he not been there. And I'm like, thank God he was the headliner. He really is the conduit of that information and that character in such a powerful way. I was really, really thankful. And in real life, Jimmy was looking up to Cedric the way that Will looks up to Billy G. And I had no idea. The first day he shows up on set, Cedric, I had never met him. And usually as a stand-up comic, you meet everybody at some point. Mm. And Jimmy had never met him earlier. And the first thing Jimmy told him was that his walk-on music was the song that Cedric walked out to in Kings of Comedy for the first 2 years of Jimmy's career. Mm. I thought, holy shit, that's kind of wild that it really is happening. So that really set the precedent for their relationship on and off screen.
Yeah, because I feel like that headliner's got like, I think a lot of people probably don't think as much about the headliner in the sense that, you know, that person's already been a success and so on and so forth. But they've got their own story too, right? Because they're still trying to remain relevant, or they're trying to, you know, get known for new things as opposed to older things, I guess.
Yeah, the you know, I think once you get established, you're trying to, you know, there's the lack of relevance that you can deal with. I mean, mm-hmm. anybody can strike gold at any given time. And I think the one thing most established comics know is that we're all stocks. You know, our value goes up and down, but the clubs will always, always have our backs, which is great. The industry, mm-hmm. on the other hand, doesn't. So you've got to generate constantly, especially this day and age, with so much going on, to stay relevant. It's even harder now more than ever because let's say you had a Netflix special 3 years ago, or a Comedy Central special 3 years ago, you could have toured off of that special for another 2 years, another 3 years. But now the fact that Netflix churns out a new hour special from someone relevant once a week for 52 days a year, it almost makes them non-relevant now. It's really sad to see the overwhelming influx of content that I think is unmerited, because now Netflix has gone after all the big fish, and now it's identity, right? It's like, oh, this person checks this box, this box, this box. Let's give them an hour. And I think that they're starting to saturate the market in stand-up comedy. And I feel bad for comics. I understand the money grab. I understand the fact that you want to be in the party, right? And Netflix is the party right now. But there are slowly comics like Joe List, Mark Norman, and quite a few other comics, especially out of New York, that are like, all right, you didn't give me an hour special? Well, then fuck it. I'll put it up on YouTube. And now they're getting 4 million, 5 million views on these things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's, for every comic that's on that platform, there's 10 other fucking rocking comics that aren't on that platform. And I think now the comics have found a way to stay relevant, minus the anointment of the almighty Netflix these days.
Yeah, you used to have something about a special that was actually special, it would show up on HBO, and it was another 3 years before you saw another one a lot of the time. And you're right, now they're like just cramming as much as they can in there. I don't even know who's supposed to be funny in all of those, lineup a lot of times. Cause I'll look for specials and I'm like, well, I know Dave Chappelle. I'm going to watch the Dave Chappelle thing.
Of course. Yeah.
But then like, then it gets into some, I was like, I have never heard of this person in my life. There's a lot of these kind of comics, by the way, where like, maybe I'm just dumb or whatever, but it's like, they've been filling arenas and everything. And I'm like, who? I don't know.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's what I miss about entertainment is that it used to be communal, right? We all, even if you didn't watch the show, you knew about it, you heard about it. But now entertainment is so fractured. There are shows I have friends on that I've never even heard of the show. And I'm like, you're on what? Like, I know you. I want to support you.
I know you.
Crazy. Like, it happens all the time. You're like, where you been? Oh, I've been filming the third season. I'm like, third season? What? I follow you on Instagram. Like, I should have known about this. Like, there is so many of those. And the fact that, like the Oscars, the Emmys, like there are awards for shows that none of us have ever seen or heard of. So I think there's a lack of that investment to go ahead and watch those things. And I think that when you have these pay streaming avenues, half the time people don't finish watching the content because they watch a few minutes. Fuck it. I'll just go back to, Star Wars and watch Phantom Menace for the 80th time. I feel like the lack of community in entertainment is kind of what's disheartening to me. And like you said, our specials used to be those things. They were something you could draw towards. It's tentpoles, it's franchises, and it's sports, unfortunately. And right now, the pandemic is the most communal thing that this country has experienced in a long time. So yeah. It's crazy days.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I would love to know, just your general, like, first off, we talked about the bombing and everything. Like, what is it about, what is in a stand-up comic psyche? Is it almost like a NASCAR driver who doesn't care about death, that a stand-up comic can go up there and tell jokes and then not be funny? I've heard some perspectives. Some people love it. They love the fact that they've bombed. But the other people, I'm just like, that has to be just such a fracture to your psyche. But
first,
how do you get
anybody
over
that says, anybody that says they like bombing, nobody likes bombing. There's anybody that says, I like to bomb, I love that feeling. A, they suck as a comic. And B, probably somebody that'll go to the red light district and spend $200 for somebody to shit on them because daddy didn't hug them. I'm telling you, nobody fucking likes bombing at all. The whole point of being on stage is to get a laugh. That laugh is the dopamine. That laugh is the drug. And that's the high comics are chasing on a nightly basis. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes it.
Right. But how do you cope with it? How do you figure it out? You just say, I'll be better next time, and that's it? Or is there a process that you go through?
There certainly is a process. I think what the process is that you get comfortable. You understand your heart rate goes down. You get comfortable with the fact. It's like going up to one of those meter dives, right? There's the 5 meter dive, the 10 meter dive. And I think probably the first 300 times you go up on that 10 meter dive, you'll be scared as fuck. Mm-hmm. But it's the 301st time that you go, I've done this 300 times. I know what I'm doing now. And it's the gradual marathon mindset of knowing I'm going to be here tomorrow. This is part of the gig. And then you develop an arsenal of weapons too. You start developing lines on the fly. Okay, well, that joke sucked. Well, now you have a line for it. Or that guy said something. Now I have a line for it. So, you know, it's funny because the first time I was on stage after the pandemic hit was maybe 3 months into it. I go to Miami and I'm on stage and I hadn't, you know, it's like running every day. You got to run every day, train a little bit for a marathon. And I was really rusty. But somebody said something and instantly, at a reflex, the lines started coming back to me. And I remembered all my lines that I hadn't said in a while. Now, granted, it's only been 3 months, but still, it's 23 years of experience coming up with those lines that I was able to kick in the high gear again and go, oh, okay, I got this. I remember how to do this again. But yeah, I think you just deal with it. You get used to it. Your heart rate goes down and you develop great lines to encounter any problem.
Mm-hmm. Like hecklers, right?
Oh, hecklers. I love hecklers. I love it.
Can I ask you about this then? I don't understand what it is in the mind of a paying audience member where they want to somehow denigrate somebody who's up there doing their life's work. I've sure. seen it happen. Did you see Kevin Pollak with us in New York?
No. I saw Patton Oswalt. With
right. Yeah, I've seen so many shows interrupted by hecklers. What is the actual percentage of the times that this happens? Is it overblown? And I just, can you tell me why they do it? Do you know why?
Sure. I think Johnny Hotcakes is the guy that wears the Santa hat at the office party and gets laughs, and he's out with his boys. He's had a few drinks. They pre-gamed at Chili's, and now he's ready to take on the big guys. And I think that's what happens. And immediately they realize, you know, you got a white belt at a strip mall Taekwondo, and you're going against jiu-jitsu masters. You know, that's ultimately what it comes down to. I'd say it's probably 30-35% of the time you get heckled, just part of the business. It's part of it. And sometimes comics engage. You know, like I love doing crowd work. My first 10 minutes is usually crowd work. You get in, you establish your rapport with the audience, and then you go into your material. And when I was a young comic in New York City, I was doing 7-8 sets a night. And I would always say one of my sets I'll dedicate just to crowd work. And that was a tool I sharpened over the years. And there's many different facets of stand-up comedy. You can be a stand-up comic, right? But people don't realize there's many different versions of it. Like Jeff Ross is the best at roasting. He's so good at roasting. Mm-hmm. And that's a muscle I do not have. I'm not good at roasting. I don't have it. I don't have the capacity to say those things that they say.
I don't blame him.
To their fucking face sometimes. It's just like, whoa. But crowd work, I definitely am better at that than most comics. I'd say it's one of the things I'm really good at. And then, you know, I'm slowly getting better as a writer all these years. I was very animated when I started off. And that was because you're displacing energy with written material. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten much better at less energy and more focused on the writing. So there's different facets. And I think even like when you go to comic club, you see somebody like Wendy Liebman, who's a great joke writer, but it's like setup punch, setup punch, setup punch. And after like 30 minutes, you're like, are we going to switch gears or just one gear the whole time? And as much as I appreciate a comic like that, and there's some great fucking jokes in there, I want to be entertained, you know, so I always try to keep that focus when I'm performing as well.
You did 13 in one night, right? 13?
Yeah, the record was a tell. He did 12. And at the time, young comics were doing like their own like little audio CDs and stuff. And I thought, well, I'll do a DVD because that'll have staying power. And I went out and just said, you know, I'm going to schedule it so that I'll probably tie the record. Not that anybody even gives a shit in New York City. It's like, okay, you did 13. Who gives a fuck? But for most people to see like that doc, it's on YouTube. It's called 13 or Bust. Bill Burr has hair in it. That's how long ago this was shot. Bobby Kelly was skinny. And Dub Davidoff and I look the same, but we did it. And I wanted to give people like some semblance of what a night as a stand-up comic can be. So we have this roundtable discussion. There's the catching up with comics between gigs. And you're just cab show. And I've never in my life had it where I walk out and a cab was there. I've missed shows in New York City, which the club owners don't like. And I thought, all right, I'm going to miss it. But that night, there was a cab that happened to pull up in front of every one of those venues. And it was fucking great. And I was because I could have done 14 that night. Because I had heard afterwards there was another show that goes till 3 in the morning. I was like, fuck, I could have done it. But I would never do it now. Never at my age. Fuck that.
Did you do like the same bit when you went through?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I apologize. Look, the film and concept is great. The material is fucking dog shit. So I apologize to anybody that goes out and watches it.
I can't imagine. I mean, you know, you think about like Broadway actors or even stage actors doing the same take every time, the same line every time. But that's a limited run. And you do that 13 times in one night. It's just wild to replicate that same energy for each and every instance for each individual audience.
Yeah, and the one thing I will say I like in that doc is that, to go to your point, is that, you know, when you're younger, look, you only got, you know, so much time. But I remember I did a show literally back to back, one show, the exact same set, great in one show, bombed in the other venue. And it was like, it's the same delivery, same cadence, same joke, same melody. It was just not my night in that room. It's just weird. Sometimes it just happens. You don't have that electricity. And you could blame it on the audience. I hate comics that go, oh, this audience sucks. It's like, no, you suck. Because you didn't have the blue wire. You couldn't figure out how to make it work.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's an interesting perspective, because you hear that all the time. You hear, like, this audience is cold. This is, you know, not responding and stuff like that. And it's the fault of the warm-up.
There's always a
whatever.
Way.
Yeah. And you got to kind of figure that out on the fly, right?
You got to figure it out. Don't ever blame the audience. Blame yourself. You're the fucking professional. I've had incidents, you know, I've seen it all. I've had a fucking bar stool thrown at me. It cracked my head open. Jeez, I got 8 staples in the back of my head, which sucked in New York City, because once everybody heard about it, for 2 weeks I was called the chairman. And it was like, all right, thanks, guys. You go to the comic strip live and you look at your headshot, and they literally tape staples to my headshot. So it was like, you know, there's no place worse. No worse industry if you have, you know, some overmounting failure for all the other comics to put a magnifying glass and reminded you of it for the next few years.
Is Cedric the Entertainer based on anybody you know, or is it sort of like an amalgam in this?
All the characters, to be completely honest, are me. You know, I was Will Chu for many years. I was Chris Palmer, absolutely, for a few years. I indulged in the nightlife and, you know, maybe didn't take things so seriously and just enjoyed the fact that I was a big fish in a small pond. And I am currently Billy G. I do go to clubs and I'm kind of there to do my job. And I do have those conversations with younger comics. I've done it for a long time, and it's not that I don't like it. I fucking hate everything about stand-up comedy except for performing. I love performing. Mm. I hate to travel. I hate the hotels. I hate eating out. I'm eating by myself all the time. I go to movies by myself all the time. Like, at some point, you just kind of want the camaraderie. And that's why comics that go on the road constantly, like myself, love going to the Comedy Store on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, because you can catch up with everybody. You can see everybody. And now these people deal with a similar, you know, experience. Just last weekend, you know, Chris Porter's in Cleveland. I was in, you know, Alabama, and we catch up and hear how the week was. So, you know, it's a profession of solitude. And Billy G, at the end of the day, if I were to hone in and say he is based on one person, I got a lot of inspiration from Billy Gardell. And that's why his name is Billy G. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Billy is on Mike. He was on Mike and Molly. He's on Bob Loves Abishola. And years ago, when I was just a headlining comic, I got booked on a Jameson whiskey tour, which took 4 established headliners and put them all on the same tour. And Billy was the closer. I toured with Bert Kreischer, Pete Corielli, Danny Bevins. There's a lot of great comics on this tour. So we go out, and I learned so much from Gardel. And the one line that stuck in my head like a one-hit wonder that he told me years ago when I was writing this, I put in, is that when I was a young comic, I used to think that I had to make the audience laugh so I feel good. Now I make the audience laugh so that they feel good. It's the best job in the world. Mm. And when you're younger and you hear that, it was like, oh, that's fucking great. And maybe there's some truth to that. But the older I get, the more I appreciate that. And that was, I think, one of the last lines Cedric says to Jimmy before he leaves, one of the last lines in the film, which I find very impactful.
Yeah. There's a scene that I really liked in here, and I don't know if you meant for it to come off this way, but
the answer is yes.
Okay. All right. And then we don't even have to answer that question.
Given your setup, I would say yes. I would just
fantastic. I'm going to just go ahead and close the show now. There's a point. The first time that Jimmy O Yang and Cedric the Entertainer are in the diner, and he's asking what advice would you give to young comics, mm-hmm. and Cedric, he gives him like some bullshit, yep. Write and perform basically is what it comes mm-hmm. down to. But there's a scene, and you don't make a big deal out of it. That's why I'm asking you this question, because I thought it was a kind of an interesting, complex type of thing that you put in here, is when Whitney Cummings shows up.
Sure.
And she starts talking to Cedric the Entertainer, and she says, "You gave me the best advice." Mm-hmm. And he tells her what that advice was. There's a shot on Jimmy O Yang where it's like, "You didn't tell me that." Basically, is what it looked like to me, and maybe I'm just imagining things, but maybe that's. I thought that was a good scene where it looked like he had sort of been slighted in a way.
Well, I think your perception of it is half what I intended.
Okay.
What it was is that she's the beacon of hope, right? She's proof positive of the aspirations that Jimmy has, where if you go out with Cedric or Billy G, if you listen to his advice, if you take it to heart, you're on your way. And so whatever it is that he's disseminating to these younger comics, if they breathe it in, if they take it in like a sponge and keep it with them, you're on your way. And so he was disseminating advice to Jimmy. He's disseminating advice to Whitney. And she's like, no, what you told me is if I write things, it's more personal. And you're seeing she's doing the Tonight Show. She just did an independent film, et cetera, et cetera. And so Will's sitting there looking at these two going, all right, that's what I got to do. I've got to stay on track. This has got to resonate within me. So then he goes up and he takes all the things that Billy G has told him over the course of the weekend. And now he's ready to try to, really take a stab at his advice. And he did the work. He did the work in the park. He did the work in the condo. And he really got serious about it. So in some small way, is he going to be victorious? You got to tune in and watch the film, I guess, right?
Yeah, right.
That was the point of that scene, yeah.
It's wild that everybody's so fucking nice in this movie. Like, in their own way, are there... I know there's assholes in comedy, right?
Sure,
like But everybody in this... Like you said with Alex Moffat's character, even when he tries to be douchey and they actually kind of, like, preface his thing, like, oh, man, you're going to really be in for it. But no, he's likable in a certain way, and he's relatable, as is Billy G, as is even Whitney Cummings in a limited role. The only one that's really an asshole is Bill Burr, and he's not even a comedian.
That's right, yeah.
but I assume that you've encountered the opposite of this. I appreciate that you're focusing on the more positive nature the relationship, but
it's funny to bring it up because there was a comic at the beginning in the open mic scene. So if you notice, Moshe Kasher is at the open mics, and he was an alternative comic that approached Will in the open mics that Kathleen Madigan hosted, and he came up to him with his cup of hot tea, and he's dressed like a hipster, and he goes, "Oh, are you still doing this?" Very condescending way. And he's like, "Yes, Sasha, I'm still doing this." And he looks at Sasha, looks at Will and goes, "Oh, did you get that? Did you, oh," he says, "did you blow Toby Keith for that shirt?" And he goes, no, I blew Toby Keith because he's a great entertainer. And Will walks away. And it was such a fun, like, dynamic, because there is this snobbery from the alt scene to anybody that's not holier than thou in their realm. And so I had this little nod to the alt scene to say, fuck off. And nice. Unfortunately, like with most things in film, as you guys know, you got to cut things. And we had to trim that for time, unfortunately, which really bummed me out, because I you know, there's a part of me that's not a huge fan of that scene, because there's a snobbery on their end as opposed to a lack of snobbery on everybody else's end.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what comes across on this, very much so, from the top down. I mean, it's not like the Chip character is trying to fuck this guy over. He's trying to, if he's good, go ahead. You know, I want to use you in my other venues and everything, but if you're not, get the fuck out of here. You know, I don't have time for it.
Yeah. If you can't, you know, that's why he establishes the rules pretty early, you know, deal with the hecklers, stay on time and have a great show, make the audience laugh. That's what he sells. So he tells them the rule book. You just have to do those things. You'll work here again. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy encounters them and does not do well.
All right. Well, what, anything else, guys?
I do have to ask a random question, because I promised my 9-year-old daughter I would. What was it like working with Debbie Ryan?
I'll tell you what, she is a fucking pro, a total That's pro. Awesome. And unfortunately for us, what we learned is that the audience just wanted to get on the road. They didn't give a shit about Will and you know, Jen dating at all. Mm-hmm. And originally what was in the film, again, you got to trim and truncate things based on what the audience tells you in test screenings. There was a little friction between them, and what originally was in is that she was saying, oh, this weekend we're going to take a road trip. It's going to be great. This is our first road trip together. And she was so excited about it. Then he gets offered the thing. He goes, honey, you know how much I love stand-up. She's like, I know you're passionate. I'm just a little miffed. But she's like, you got to go. This is a big opportunity. So he goes. And at the end of the film, they get in a Prius and they're driving off to Kansas City together. And so she got the road trip and he got the next booking. So that was all supposed to tie in very nicely together for them. Unfortunately, again, the audience just wanted to see them hit the road. But to answer your 9-year-old, she was so professional. She was so sweet. And she was really, really funny. And she was asking a lot of questions about stand-up comedy, which I thought was fascinating. And I didn't really know her body work. I'd seen Insatiable, and I thought she was great. And now that my kids are old enough and they have Disney Plus, Jessie's constantly on.
Yep.
And she's got great chops. I mean, she's really, really funny. And if I ever had the opportunity to work with her again, I'd do it in a heartbeat. She was nothing but a complete joy.
Yeah, Jessie's one of those weird – it's kind of – you kind of have to pick and choose. Like, it's not that it's like, you know, it's not for our age, obviously. But course, if it's a show you have to watch with your kid, it's not a bad one, I guess.
If you watch Jessie in your 30s or 40s, you're an Amber Alert waiting to happen.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Man, there's some red flags. I've been doing it all wrong.
Yeah. But she was awesome, as was everybody on the set. I didn't have any issues with anybody. And the great thing about directing this with all the comics is that most of them didn't want to improv, because comics inherently are lazy by nature. They just want to show, oh, we want to say, oh, do that. Yeah. Nice. Great. Thank you. Now we're staying on story. But like, I didn't have to tell Russell Peters, Eliza Schlesinger, or Brooks Whelan, okay, this is the radio scene when comics go on the road. Like, they knew it. They know those morning DJs on the morning zoo, and they know how they treat comics. And that's why Eliza's constantly on her phone, like, okay. And Brooks is on his computer. Nobody's paying attention to Jimmy when he's talking. So they knew it. They nailed it. And that was the fun aspect of all the characters throughout the course of the film. The only one that I maybe had to ask for a little more was Segura, who's getting blown in the trailer park.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so the follow-up to that story is one of my – there's a throwaway line that I'm not even going to mention.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely genius. And yeah. The fact that it happens when it happens is, you know, your rock bottom, but it's kind of a hilarious rock bottom.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Segura was great in that. And he I remember the day he showed up, actually, his wife was due to give birth at any moment to their next son. Wow. And he said when he got dressed in the cop uniform and walked on set, he goes, just to let you know, Christina's due any moment. I'm like, he's like, I might have to leave. I'm like, oh, fuck. let's go. But he got in that cop car. And it was a real cop car. He goes, so these lights work? They go, yeah. And he goes, the speaker work? They go, oh, yeah. He goes, can I do it? I go, you do whatever the fuck you want. So he improv'd a lot of stuff. And that scene you hear in the film, which is pretty aggressive. Yeah. That was the least aggressive of all the things he was saying.
Oh, my God.
One day, maybe I'll get to share with everybody the crazy shit Sigourney was saying through that speaker. But we were fucking dying laughing.
Here's another. Like, you had a couple of a producing team of Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley on this. So what kind of input did they have into this film? Did they just say, "Hey, just do what you want," or did they have a vision themselves, or what?
Yeah, I think Vince. The great thing about Vince is he addressed early on tone in this film. He's like, you know, what kind of film do you want to make? And I told him, and he said, you have a real shot to make something really realistic and grounded. And he said, you know, there are elements in the film where things get a little broad. And he said, I'm going to leave it up to you. It's your film, but keep that in mind. And in the edit, it was really, really something that resonated with me. And he came in towards the end of the edit and really was impactful and extremely helpful. And not only with story, he's a huge, huge fan of Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, but he's also really, really helpful in terms of tone. And we were able to, I went for gold on some scenes, you know, for example, like Bill Burr was shittier in the film. And he was eating sushi and he had like tummy issues. And there was a scene where he kept eating the sushi, even though he knew it was bad for him. And he was in the toilet and Jimmy's looking for him. He's like, I got this thing. And then Bill comes out, he's talking to him. And then he fucking has this stomach pain and he's sitting there and he's wincing and he's groaning. He's like, oh, and it fucking made me laugh so hard. And it was one of those things where Vince was like, do you really want that in? Like Bill Burr and a shit joke is basically what it's coming down to. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And we learned pretty early on what the tone of the film would be. And I think it's a better film for it. Look, you could go for gold in some scenes, right? Whatever. But at least they really happened and they were grounded in reality. That trailer park scene, it's fucking crazy. But I think the fact that we, you know, even the way you shot it, you had to shoot it from Jimmy's perspective. Mm. And it just grounds it a little more as opposed to wides of the trailer and seeing what happens. When you see it from his perspective, I think it's a little scarier. And grounded. So that was the great thing about working with Vince. And then Peter's been fucking working in this industry since he was like a kid.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything that you could throw past Peter, especially on set, that would fucking whiz him. He was completely a pro. And there were times on the production where things go wrong. There something's gonna go wrong every fucking day. And you gotta keep your day, keep it on budget, especially when it's an independent film. And this guy is working fucking miracles on a daily basis. And to be honest with you, I don't know if the film would have even been made if Peter wasn't a producer. There were many times where the film almost fell apart and he kept it on track. And I'm sure that happens on 1,000 projects, but thank God he was there.
Steve, thanks for talking about your movie, giving us your time here. The opening act is, you know, anybody who's really interested in stand-up comedy should watch this. And I think that's a lot of people. So, so
guys, I don't want this day to end. You're the best friends I've ever had. So can we just,
right?
Can you just listen to me eat? I don't want to leave you guys. I'm concerned. Yeah,
I understand it, man. The love is real. The love is real.
I just want us all to sit in front of a fireplace and prick our fingers and swap blood samples and become blood brothers after this.
Well, I did that just last night, though, so it's gonna be tough to do it again
while watching Jesse.
Yes, while watching Jesse. Let's make this as dark as possible.
that is a visual.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. The opening act comes out on October 16th in theaters, VOD, and digital. I'm guessing theaters is drive-ins and stuff like that.
I would say theaters or drive-ins, or if you live in a red state.
yeah, that's true.
I don't know how to
describe it. Hey, man, we live in one, so. Okay, we like to thank Steve Byrne for coming in and sharing his time. The opening act, October 16th. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Jonathan Watkins, and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Really can't wait to kind of dive into a little bit, like even kind of your previous career, if you're all right with that.
Yeah, anything you want to ask, totally. I'm totally
anything.
Great.
Anything, Steve.
Anything. Sexuality, all of it. Yes. Why do I have to legally knock on doors and introduce myself as a new neighbor? Yeah, you can ask me about that.
All right. That was my first one. That was my first question.
That's amazing. My God. That's what I ask everybody in every interviewee. Why is that? Okay.
And so I will shut up and turn it over to Chris, and I can't wait to talk to you. Thank you again.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Steve, I'm going to do my usual, you know, like intro bullshit, and then we can, we can talk about this movie.
And Chris, you were probably going to do this, but Steve, can you stay on the line for a second? So that we can make sure that Jonathan downloads everything and Chris is going to do his outro bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. He thought my intro bullshit was good.
No. I know what you do. I know you present the mozzarella sticks, but I've been waiting for that T-bone tomahawk. So I cannot wait to hear what I'm served.